Welcome to the Software Process and Measurement Cast number 452. I'm Tom Cagley, your host, and in the Spamcast 452, we feature our essay on personal process improvement. We are responsible for our own path in life. Stepping back and reviewing where we are today and where we want to be tomorrow is a form of retrospective. Just like any other retrospective, the goal is to change the trajectory of the path you're on. In the second column this week, Kim Priest, the software sensei, discusses ethics in software. Ethics guide, or they don't, practitioners of all types. Many certification organizations include ethics statements, but rarely have teeth to enforce those ethics. Kim asks whether this approach makes sense. Finally, anchoring the cast is John Quigley and his Alpha and Omega of Product Development column. John is beginning a three-column theme on the impact of people and learning on product development. One of the places you can find John is at Value Transformation LLC, link in the show notes. Continuous personal improvement. Thomas M. Cagley Jr., Megan E. Cagley. I believe the concept of the beginner's mind holds a substantial clue to why some people and organizations embrace or resist change. The beginner's mind is a concept from Zen Buddhism. It refers to having an attitude of openness, eagerness, and lack of preconceptions when studying a subject. The beginner's mind can be present even when studying an advanced level. Quoting the Zen teacher Suzuki, in the beginner's mind are many possibilities. In the expert's mind, there are few. The beginner's mind embodies the emotional qualities of enthusiasm, creativity, and optimism. These qualities are critical for tackling tough problems and for innovation. The beginner's mind is just one framework for understanding why some organizations and individuals seem to embrace the boundlessness of the environment around them, but nonetheless, it is a powerful tool for self-reflection or judging change readiness. I'd like to address the idea of change willingness through the filter of the beginner's mind from two perspectives. The first is from the point of view of the constraints we accept or create for ourselves and our organization. And the second would be to reflect on attitudes that help us accelerate embracing change. Constraints. Experts. Many, if not most people reading this essay, either are or on their way to becoming experts. Expertise can be a double-edged sword. In order to become an expert, knowledge and hopefully wisdom must be accumulated, which can allow an expert to see the depth and breadth of a specific topic, providing the basis to solve many problems. The effort and sacrifice required to become an expert can, at the same time, create barriers leading to a lack of systems thinking and flexibility. Embracing the attributes of expertdom has consequences much in the same way cholesterol hardens and clogs the arteries. It can generate a need to defend our comfort zone when challenged or even when circumstances change. Another classic problem with experts is that it is easy to become a one-trick pony. For example, I am sure we can all think of someone that has arrived at their level of expertise by using a specific technique. For example, Scrum, Kanban, or classic project management techniques. The default option is to try that one technique first without respect for changing circumstances. Taking the point of view of the beginner, it would be easy to spend the time needed to review the problem, even if they had seen it before. Why? It is because they would not expect the circumstances to be the same before judging whether any specific technique or piece of knowledge is relevant. I remember a mentor early in my career that suggested that I practice the black art of expertdom, but not the behaviors that the moniker suggests in order to avoid downsizing in the short run. It was a good strategy. However, in the longer run, constant reinvention has been more effective. Shoulds. Rules and shoulds are an integral part of modern corporate life. Rules come in many flavors, from policies to software development cycles, to informer coding standards. The problem with many shoulds is that they reflect other people's ideas of how we should work and what is best based on their perception of the environment. The beginner will question the rules and shoulds to separate what is necessary and desirable because they do not have the same preconceived notions. End versus the journey. A few years ago, I wrote an essay on my trek to Machu Picchu in Peru. The lost city of Machu Picchu was incredible. However, much of the learning experience was derived not from the ruins themselves, but from the four-day hike through a myriad of climates. It would have been easier to take the train instead of carrying a backpack through the Andes, but the sights and the self-knowledge derived from the journey would have been lost. The same can be said for the problem-solving required to develop, maintain, and enhance software. Knowledge is built not only from the result, Machu Picchu, but from the journey, the hike. P.S. This is why we have retrospectives and postmortems. Fear of failure. As our lives become more complicated, and or we invest the effort in developing a specialty, it is easy to take the safe and well-trodden path because we feel that failing represents a limitation that can't be easily overcome or will affect more than just ourselves. By pushing us to the safe path, the fear of failure reduces the possibility of bringing innovative solutions to bear on development problems and limits the experience that lead to learning something new. Taking chances is critical to expanding knowledge. My advice is to experiment, fail fast, fail often, but not constantly. And don't fail twice doing the same thing the same way. Defensiveness. There are many paths to defensiveness, many of which we have already explored. One of the reasons defensiveness is bad is that when you become defensive, communication becomes more difficult. As soon as you become defensive, barriers are erected, which makes it difficult to listen, accept, and process data that is at odds with your point of view. Frankly, being seen to be defensive will chase away those who have different points of view, which can only serve to reinforce the original point of view, which creates barriers between ideas, a self-reinforcing cycle that can't have a good ultimate outcome. Been there, done that. If I had a nickel for every time I've heard the expression, been there, done that, I would be a rich man. A beginner does not make the mistake of assuming that since an idea has been tried in the past, that it can't or won't work now. As we have noted before, the world is a dynamic place and circumstances change, and therefore, when problem solving, all possibilities should be on the table. Consider problem-solving techniques that evaluate alternatives as quickly as possible. Prototyping and experimentation, spikes and tracers in agile parlance, are tools to quickly evaluate solutions. Preconceptions. Constraints are an integral part of life, the universe, and projects. Most of us have been educated to discover the constraints we are operating under and deal with them. The constraints we have been taught to find and therefore accept as real can blind us from the possibilities in a manner similar to a filtered vision that expertise can bring to the table. The beginner does not begin with a set of preconceived constraints. At the very least, a beginner will question all preconceptions of the world around them. Note, not all preconceptions are bad. For example, the preconception that holding a meeting while driving in traffic is generally not a good idea is probably not worth spending a lot of time questioning or testing. In the business world, it is easy for processes to pick up additional steps that were added for a specific purpose or to ensure a specific incident does not happen again, which may no longer be applicable or that the solution is overkill. If the step does not make sense, just accepting that you should do it because the process says so is generally not a great answer. I'm not suggesting that the beginner's mind is not a get-out-of-jail-free card for disobedience, but rather the status quo may not be the most efficient solution, and pushing to reinvigorate it through change is a better answer. Accelerators. There are many ways to enhance the beginner's mind so that you can unlock creativity and innovation. A strategy is to take positions diametrically opposed to the constraints we just discussed. For example, to embrace the beginner's mind, an expert could quit being defensive on new ideas while capitalizing on the knowledge and wisdom gathered while becoming an expert. Bottom line, experts would need to resist developing barriers and being defensive when confronted with new ideas. Other mechanisms to accelerate embracing the beginner's mind include openness. The beginner's mind sees the possibilities in every situation because it is open. The goal of openness is to help ignore the constraints of what has been done in the past or just setting on the solution our area of expertise makes us comfortable with. I suggest investigating a new concept, taking a class on calligraphy, a nod to Steve Jobs, or just reading a book on a topic outside of your comfort zone to help open your mind. Openness is just as much a learned behavior as is the fear of failure or defensiveness. Become a learner. Something I've talked to John Quigley about and will be on the Alpha and Omega of product development in the near future. Much has been written about the need for continuous learning and training in IT. The reality is true for any profession, though. There really should be no debate whether it is the responsibility of the organization or the individual to continually enrich or reinvent themselves. You are in control of your own life and career. In order to actively enrich your horizons, you need to actively be learning at all times, which requires an open and questioning mind. Time, success, and expertise can contribute to hardening of filters, which slow learning, but only if you let them. I'm not suggesting you should become a failure with no expertise and that you should die young. Rather, I'm suggesting that you recognize that filters we erect to focus our attention can lead to myopia, which reduces the possibility of innovation and growth. While being a lifetime learner is not an immunization against career tragedy, it can reduce the risk and transition time if and when career shocks occur. It also makes you more fun at parties. Boundaries. It is easy to see boundaries all around us. Between people, boundaries between teams, boundaries between processes, boundaries between applications, and boundaries between organizations, just to name a few. By definition, boundaries are barriers. It is easy to let experience and fear cause us to see a barrier as insurmountable and retreat into more comfortable territory. A beginner does not see boundaries as insurmountable obstacles, but rather new territory and ideas to explore. Simply put, a beginner looks for a way to succeed rather than a reason an idea won't work. My experience has been that it is far easier for someone to see how a change can work than it is to see how it can work. As leaders, we often exhort those around us to embrace continuous process improvement as a path to improve our team and organization. Just as important as process improvement is the need for continuous personal improvement. As a first step toward continuous process improvement, every person should identify the goal they are working toward. The concept of the beginner's mind provides a framework to consider why some people and organizations have an easier time embracing new ideas and why they innovate serially. Each step away from the joy of change and experimentation toward constraints and deterministic solution creates barriers between people and ideas and new solutions which generate a risk of systemic failure. Become a beginner again. Take a class on a topic you've always been interested in but haven't done anything about. Relish the experience of being excited about learning, not about being the expert. Ask the stupid questions as you explore the boundaries of the topic. The experience and feelings from this simple act can act as a template that you can translate into your day-to-day world to liberate the beginner's mind and the potential for innovation and creativity lurking within. The next step toward the goal needs to be the most important task, MIT, you address every day. One of my primary personal goals is to not get stuck in a rut and continue learning. My most important task every day is to take a step on a path toward continuous learning. Planning my day begins with identifying my MIT for the day, whether that is researching and writing a new blog entry, recording and editing an interview on the Software Process and Measurement Cast, or reading a few pages in a book. One of my first tasks begin by checking my MIT off the list. The idea for identifying and addressing your MIT early in the day is not a new concept. Kevin Cruz, been on the Spamcast multiple times, 398, 262, New York Times bestselling author, serial entrepreneur, and podcaster wrote, "Put simply, the most important things are to know what to focus on and how you're going to get it done. I call this always knowing your MIT the most important task." Putting your MIT first every day, ensure it gets done, and you move one step closer to your ultimate goal. As a step towards my goal of continuous personal improvement, and perhaps as a tool to influence you to add continuous improvement to your list of priorities, I ask the contributors of the Software Process and Measurement Cast to suggest one book for their blog readers and podcast listeners to read when they take their summer vacation. The responses were Jeremy Berrio of the QA Corner recommended Explore It by Elizabeth Hendrickson. This is Jeremy's go-to book on exploratory testing. Steve Tendon, co-author of Tame Flow, recommends Actionable Agile Analytics by Dan Vicente. Steve praises the book, saying that it is a great combination to anyone's knowledge of flow and quantitative flow management. He goes further to say that Dan's book must be considered as mandatory reading for anyone implementing the Tame Flow approach. Kim Priest, the software sensei, also in this episode, recommends The Interior Castle by St. Teresa of Avila. When asked why he would recommend this book, Kim said she speaks to real transformation, which is always personal. Nothing technical even comes close. John Quigley, also in this episode, the Alpha and Omega of Product Development, recommends The Fifth Discipline by Peter Senge. John read the book as part of his MBA and indicated that it made a large impression. John and I also talked about the concepts in the book for an upcoming column on the Spamcast. Gene Hewson, Form Follows Function, recommends a book he's currently reading, Freakonomics. Gene suggests that the book focuses on cause and effect and motivation. Gene suggests the book's focus on the cause, effect, and motivation are important exercises for everyone involved in change. Personally, I'll pitch reading The Science of Successful Organizational Change. Steve Adams is leading the reread of the book on the podcast currently. I'm currently reading the book for the first time, and it is simply eye-opening. A wonderful set of recommendations. Whether you're in the northern or southern hemispheres, it's a good time to step back and reflect on your goals. Continuous personal improvement is critical to staying relevant and flexible in a dynamic world. Taking a step toward continuous personal improvement, your MIT, by making time on your calendar to take a step forward first thing every day, whether you're on the beach or sitting in your cozy study.
This is your software sensei, Kim Priest. Today I would like to discuss ethical issues in software development, including work by the test team. What are we talking about when we talk about ethics? Well, ethics comes from two similar sounding Greek words, which can mean either moral character or habit. In the West, Aristotle is the major figure in ethical theorizing, and Aristotelian concepts still hold sway in our society no matter what we think about our philosophy. In the East, we have several other approaches. The Taoist approach, which is largely based on nature, the Hindu approach, largely revealed, and the Buddhist approach, both revealed and discovered. Nearly all professional organizations have codes of ethics. The major computer-oriented professional society is probably the Association for Computing Machinery, and they have a code of ethics and professional conduct composed of 24 items referred to as imperatives. The general imperatives are exactly that, general guidance on behaviors such as relations with society, harm to others, honesty, non-discrimination, copyrights and patents, privacy and confidentiality. The next 8 imperatives after the first are more specific, addressing quality issues and contractual obligations. The 6 after that address social responsibilities and organizational issues. The last 2 refer to the code of ethics itself. In general, codes of ethics are often non-enforceable except by forcing resignation or expulsion of members. With software development teams and test teams, I would recommend they visit the law first because laws more commonly have real teeth. The first stop would be the U.S. Code, also called the Code of Federal Regulations, or CFR. This is the law of the nation. Unfortunately, the various parts are spread through this CFR, with a few examples in parts 10, 17, 40, and 47, and of course many more parts and sections. The CFR contains information about patents and copyright, although more detail may be found on the appropriate .gov websites. Patents and copyrights refer to intellectual property and have evolved largely from confusion about what is patentable. Copyright is not so difficult. Some firms have tried to patent algorithms, which seems more like it would be a copyright issue, hence the confusion. The next stop after this would be the appropriate state laws for the state in which the development occurs. In Texas, for example, the state constitution unfortunately conflates constitutional law with statutory law, so finding anything is difficult even with the search engine. Luckily, the U.S. Code is the final arbiter even with its chaotic organization. Our third stop would be the appropriate professional organizations like the ACM we already talked about or the IEEE Computing Division and take a look at their ethical codes, professional responsibilities, and so on. And then the fourth stop should relate to those values held by the firm for which we as developers work. For example, when I was the overseer of test teams, I expected them to liberate as much error as they could find. I wanted them going for blood, metaphorically. The instant anyone began to try and make the software work, we moved them to another group in the organization. Not as punishment, but because they were missing the point. Their job was to find problems, not to make it work. That is the purpose of testing. Is finding problems, not to prove something works. This is a common fallacy in weak test teams. My point is that a huge component of our ethical approach where I worked was the discovery of software weaknesses so that we would not send inferior products to our customers. We also knew during the course of a development our test suite would grow so that at some breakpoint we had largely fumigated most of the weaknesses in the software. On the development side, we expected our teams to follow certain practices. Good internal documentation, following exemplars, paradigms, whatever you want to call them, a pattern. We didn't care much about external documentation because that is obsolete 5 minutes or 5 seconds after a developer changes the code. Hence, we used documentation engines like Doxygen, which take the internal documentation and produce an external document that's effectively up to date, insofar as the internal documentation is up to date. We also expected pre-testing before releasing the software to the test group, so obvious flaws were removed because it just caused a huge amount of churning with the test group. They didn't know what to do when they ran into an obvious flaw. Do we continue testing? Do we turn it back to the developers? The point is, the developers should have already removed obvious flaws. Also, the use of industry standard tools such as unified modeling language and static checkers. A static checker might be one of the variants of lint, which is going to go in and look for flaws in the code, calls, so on, pointer problems. Many customers over the years recommended operating systems. And small microprocessors, the gain from using an operating system is often outweighed by the overhead. Naive developers like to use interrupt-driven code, which in many cases was counterproductive, since a synchronous approach was faster and more predictable than the asynchronous behavior of interrupted code. I feel these are ethical choices as well. Should we use an operating system or not? Does it really help? Should we use interrupts or should we go synchronous? That's kind of a judgment call, and that's what ethics is about. Regardless, after all is done and said, we should look at our product and contemplate the following. Are we proud of our work? Do we want to keep this customer and keep them happy? Will we sell this product to ourselves? Ultimately, ethics, like quality, revolves around caring about what we produce. Until next time, this is your software sensei, Kim Price.
John Quigley, welcome to the Software Process and Measurement Cast.
Tom, as always, it's a wonderful time to be here. Thank you very much for having me.
John, it is always great when you bring your alpha and omega of product development to the cast. John, today I think we want to go a little further afield in terms of product development. Because I don't think product development is always just formulas, algorithms, techniques. Sometimes it's people.
I would agree with that. I'd say the fundamentals come down to the people, even with those formulas, algorithms, techniques. If your people are not motivated, if they're not approaching the work in a particular way, they're not enthusiastic about it, then if you don't have things set in place to drive the team in a one particular direction, then you're kind of without a rudder.
Well, then let's dive in with the whole concept of a learning organization, which a lot of people talk about, but I don't think a lot of people do well. What is it? Why do we care? And how do we get there?
Well, the first thing we probably need to look at, also on my summer, I handed you from a summer reading list, was Peter Singer's The Fifth Discipline. Yes. That's a really good book to understand some of these fundamentals, because it's more than just those techniques. It's in his book, he outlines some things, you know, systems thinking, personal mastery, mental models, some kind of shared vision, which drives us all working in some particular way. And something that Agile is particularly good at, or can be, if executed well, learning and spreading the learning, with at least within the context and the confines of your team, which is pretty interesting.
If we think about the stuff that Senge talked about, why does it affect organizations? Why does it affect teams? Why can't we just say, hey, everybody here ought to be as good as they need to be, and as soon as you're not, we'll just get somebody to replace you?
Yeah, that sounds a little harsh, but I suppose that could be an alternative. But the thing is, the things that you come into the company knowing are probably the things the company needs, at least part of what you need to know to work at this company. But that's not going to be the end point. You get out of college with a degree and know some stuff about software or hardware or embedded or something, but you don't understand how all the parts go together to make something happen. So it doesn't matter what you come into the company with. You're probably going to be continuously learning to stay relevant, which would be personal mastery.
Are we talking about an evolutionary scenario where organizations and people evolve based on a learning organization? Just from a tactical point of view, how do we get from a
a static sort of organization, which I really don't think many are, to something more akin to a learning organization?
Well, for me, I look at every project that a company undertakes, and I think we'll have this interleaving discussion throughout the next few podcasts we have. The mechanisms that can spread this learning and facilitate learning or provide opportunities for this personal mastery are things like what's the company going to be doing in the next X amount of time? What projects are going to drive those to those objectives that the company wishes to achieve? Is breaking into a new market or some new technology or even existing technology applied differently? These are all opportunities for some kind of learning.
I hear you. I understand what you're saying. Is it the person, the team, or the organization that's learning? Or all three?
All three. As I'm tasked with whatever position I hold in the company for a particular project, I'm supposed to do these things. So I will be doing things to learn how to achieve that. Maybe I'll be part of the planning session for some project for the parts that I own, right? If it's an agile team, well, even if it's not an agile team, my interaction with the rest of the team members, I'm going to do this part, but I need to know what somebody ahead of me is giving and what somebody behind me is going to need from me, right? Because I'm a link in a chain here. So there's opportunities for me to teach the people who are handing me, learn from the people that are handing me stuff, and learn from the people that I'm handing to that will help me set what I need to do and how I need to do it in terms of my particular tasks in this particular project.
When we talk about talent and the whole idea of evolving and pushing an organization forward, how is a learning organization tied to things like motivation, innovation, heck, even profitability, perhaps?
Let's start with innovation, because I like that one a lot. I have ceded 7 patents to the companies at which I have worked. None of them are a single idea generated from me. It may be, in some cases, I may have started the seed with the what if discussion. In some cases, somebody else said, you know, I have this idea that looks like this. And that would just spur other ideas with some of the other people that we were working together. You know, we're working together. And that whole exchange between each other, I knew some things, they knew some things, but and separately maybe don't mean much. But together, they start to mean a little something. And compiled in a good way, it actually becomes intellectual property. So there's some innovation. When it comes to the monetary side, I'm talking with a guy on Twitter, John Cutler. His Twitter handle is John Cuttlefish. He's had this thing about bets. He wants to call the project a bet. And if you explain the project in terms of bet to the people doing the work, then they start understanding things like return on investment in a different way. The reason for us to undertake this project is whatever that reason is, and there's some monetary aspect to it. Most projects have some monetary part to it, or they should. And sometimes you get those strategic ones, and in my mind, those are the ones you should run away from, or at least carefully sniff. But if you tell your team there's some monetary parts of this, and we're calling it a bet, then they can start making judgment calls on how they go to do the work based on that kind of discussion.
How do you react when you think of it as a bet? Is that work in your construct of a learning organization?
I think it does. For me, it's about risk versus reward, which is kind of the same thing as a bet. And my experience suggests that we always look at the reward, and either we don't look very hard or diligently at the risk, or we have our rose-colored glasses on when it comes to looking at the risk. So we don't really learn about these things up front. We instead, unfortunately, learn after we burn our hand on the stove yet again.
Interesting. How does that then play back into the whole idea that Senge put forward in terms of a learning organization? How do we use what you just described, you know, as a whole, right? That's a hole in an organization. How do we make a learning organization fill that hole?
Well, the first thing is you can call the bet maybe one of it maybe meets the mental model. This is the thing that we're going to try to do, and we open our minds up to what other people have to say about this, the guy who's proposing that we undertake the project, for example. Here's the bet, and here's why we think it needs to be this way. And that model of how and why and the objective is open for, I wouldn't call it criticism, but it's open for review. And that starts to line the people up in a particular way, right? The fact that this is a bet, the fact that this is, or in terms of a bet, it's something the project is, the organization is trying to undertake to hit some objective. And we want our team that's associated with this project or objective to pull on the plow, as it were, in some common direction. But for that to happen, they have to have some common understanding of that objective. That's the fundamental catalyst that brings in the rest of it, in my mind.
Okay.
Then the personal mastery is, all along, you're developing your own set of skills. For example, I started out as an engineer. And I have since, I got an MBA in marketing because I understood that product development was a lot more than the guy sitting down and writing the code or designing the embedded part. If you get a couple of specs, you look at some marketing guys handing you what they think is technical defined documentation, and you go, well, I can't really build, I could build anything based on this, or I could build nothing and still hit this target. And you start to understand that those upfront parts are just as important. And likewise, if you have great technical talent and good business acumen, but you have no project skills in your repertoire, then you're probably not going to produce this thing on time and at cost that's required to make a living off it.
So we fill the hole by learning. John, I think I've taken you further down the path than we intended to on the first step of a discussion of a learning organization. But in terms of your opinion, based on what you've seen across your wide range of experience, how important is being a learning organization in the long run?
I think if you want to stay viable, that's what you have to do. And I think Agile does that very well. And unfortunately, conventional project management does not do that quite so well. We find ourselves burning our hand on the same stove over and over again often, especially if we're in a large company. I worked at a company and a guy said, you know, it's okay to make mistakes, but it sure should be something different.
Yeah. And I get into this argument with people many times, the whole idea of fail fast kind of a scenario. The reality is, I don't think anyone suggests that you fail all the time when they say fail fast. And they most certainly don't mean fail fast with the same failure over and over and over again. I don't think anyone thinks that's a good idea.
Yeah, that doesn't benefit anybody. I think what they're trying to say is, if you're doing something different, take some measurements, learn from what you're doing as quick as you can, understand if you're getting ready to fail, and pull out and learn something from that and try something different fast.
Amen. And yeah, that's short iterations, fast feedback,
yep,
and react to it.
Exactly.
John, this has been absolutely fantastic. Thank you for bringing your alpha and omega of product development to the Software Process Measurement Cast. John, if people wanted to continue this conversation, how would they go about doing that?
Well, I'm on LinkedIn at John M. Quigley. I'm also on Twitter at John M. Quigley. And you can go to the Value Transform website and pose your questions. We put up a discussion board over there, so if you have some questions or things you want to just kick around a little bit, maybe you could visit that place.
Absolutely. And all those links will be in the show notes. Thank you, John, again, for bringing the alpha and omega of product development to the Software Process and Measurement Cast.
I always appreciate the opportunity, Tom.
In Reread Saturday News, we continue rereading The Science of Successful Organizational Change, led by Stephen Adams. This week, we dive into Chapter 1, titled Failed Change, The Greatest Preventable Cost to Business. The frightening part of this chapter is how intimately it resonates based on personal observation. Remember to buy your copy, link in the show notes. Both the author, Paul Gibbons, and the podcast will be thankful. Can you help share the Software Process and Measurement Cast? If you got a single new idea this week while listening to the podcast, please give the Spamcast a short, honest review in iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you're listening. If you leave a review somewhere, please send a copy to spamcastinfo@gmail.com. We'll be appreciative. Reviews help guide people to the cast. In the Software Process and Measurement Cast number 453, we will feature our interview with James Shore. I really think this time that we'll get it in the cast. We began with a discussion of the Agile Fluency Model, the concepts and ideas that led to the model, and then got into topics such as whether Agile can ever be method agnostic. If process improvement is a never-ending journey, why do people ask, are we there yet?